We're going to start with. Thank you. We're going to start with the 10th Perek, Perek Yud. In Perek Yud, I believe we're up to Pasuk Yud Aleph, 10-11. Yud Yud Aleph. The first few psukim tonight are really revolving around what seems like a running theme, which is the words that come out of a person's mouth. You see in the first pasuk here, Makor Chayim Pi Tzadik, that the source of life is the mouth of the wise, or the mouth of the righteous. You can interpret that in two ways, right? It could go that the which is probably a more literal understanding, that the words that the righteous say is themselves, whatever wisdom, whatever righteousness the person is saying, so that is itself something of worth for your life. Meaning Makor Chayim Pi Tzadik, he's going to speak about things that are valuable for a person in their life. Conversely, as we said last week or last time, a lot of these psukim are contrasts, little couplets. Upirisham Yechasa Chamas. The mouth of the evildoers, however, the mouth of the wicked will cover up Hamas. Hamas, as we'll see in the next couple weeks in the parsha, is referring to violence of some kind. And what you find here in this contrast is a couple interesting things. If we were to explicitly give the contrast of the reward of the result, so you would think it says Mekor Chayim Pi Tzadik, right? If the words of the righteous is life, so you would think that the mouth of the wicked would be death. But that's not what it says. Because what it's saying here is that the wicked is never interested in helping people. And at least according to this, they're not interested in hurting people necessarily either. They're simply trying to watch out for themselves. In this case, Pirushim Yechasa Chamas means that when you listen to them, oftentimes they'll just talk about things in a way that's going to avoid being punished for themselves, right? They're going to speak in a way that covers up Yechase, like a kisui. A kisui is a covering. Yechase Chamas means that they're going to sort of cover their tracks. They're going to make sure no one figures out any bad things that they did. That's probably a literal way of understanding it. But there's an interesting Hasidish take on the. Oh well, no, that's a little bit later. But the Vilna Gaon says more simply that Mekor Chaim Pi Tzadik is referring to the Torah, right? The righteous person is going to teach Torah, and when you teach Torah, that's the source of life, right? Mi Ha'ishachav Yitzchaim Oliv Yom Leros Tov. Person that wants life is going to follow the Torah and the Torah Shon Chamera, Svesachem Adamir Mirma. Similar thing here, that your mouth is dictating your life, right? And that's sort of, you know, the Chavetz Chaim, known as the Chavetz Chaim, because he kept to the laws of Lashon Hara, or at least he practiced and preached the words of Lashon Hara, to the laws of Lashon Hara, to make sure that the people are chafetz chayim if they want real life. So it's all about how you speak. It's about what are the topics you speak about, right? This is another interesting thing that can be very telling about a person. You're at a Shabbos table. What's the topic around the Shabbos table? You're in your sukkah. You know, what are the types of things that you talk about in your sukkah? This holy place, the sukkah. What kinds of conversations do you have? Very interesting to think about this pasuk in the way of how our words are indicative of who we are, right? So the one way we said was Makor Chayim Pi Tzadik, that the person who speaks will be giving over things that can help your life. Alternatively, you could, and this is my own drasha, so take it or leave it, Makor Chayim is the Pi Tzadik, right? The source of one's life is how they speak. Right, Mekor Chayim, that you want the source of your life, is Pi Tzadik. Right, if you want to know what the essence of a person's life is all about, you have to look at what they speak about. Upirushim Yechasa Chamas. But for the Rasha, the Rasha's speech is going to be indicative of the fact that he's covering something up. He's going to give away that he's really not that great of a person. Maybe he's doing other things. And the way that he speaks is going to be in a cunning way that's indicative of the fact that he's trying to cover something up. Interestingly enough, this next pasuk is probably the most explicit we've ever seen about the something we spoke about recently, the halo effect. The halo effect. So if you look at the next pasuk, Yud Beis, 10:12, Sina Ta'orer Medanim. Sina meaning hatred, Ta'orer Medanim. Ta'orer Medanim means it brings about, right? Like in Lechadodi. Right, who's saying Lechadodi? His Oeri, right? That you should wake up, Mashiach should awaken. Kumi Orech Kiva, right? Kumi Ori Kiva Orech, right? The time has come to redeem Yerushalayim. So here, Sina Ta'ora Midanim. What is hatred awaken? What does that to bring about? That brings Midanim. Midanim is an interesting word. Here, the art scroll translates it as strife. Midanim could be like we say on Friday night. I think midanim is like luxuries or pleasures. No, that's ma'ad danim. Never mind. Midanim, Rashi says, afilo avir shenis l'shichad nizkares. He doesn't give a strict explanation for it. Hold on. Right, Yurivehu. The Rebbeinu Yonah says it's about fighting. If you have hatred with a person, so it's going to cause strife. Now, what's interesting is there's no explicit activity that's causing the strife, right? We think, why do people fight? So you'll tell me because they cheated them or because they said something nasty to them, right? So what does it say here? Sina, just having hatred. Very interesting. Sina ta'orer midanim. Just harboring hatred is going to cause strife. Some connect this to the previous pasuk, right? If you look at the, I think at Rashi. No, that's not it. Where did I see this? Hold on. Right, where's Mitzudas David? Here, Hatsina Sheyesh Lo Adam Al Mi. A person has some kind of hatred. He me'oreret midanim la'asos meriva u'lahakpir al davar kal. Right? Even the smallest of little things will become big fights. You ever notice this? People that don't get along, they'll fight about everything. Maybe you've experienced it in your own life. You have maybe a boss or a coworker that just doesn't like you. Right? They're just, that you have an undercurrent of animosity either towards each other or one way to the other. And it doesn't matter what it is. You could be walking past them and they'll say something bad about you, right? You could be doing the most innocent thing and it'll become like this big deal, right? That's the concept of sinah ta'or midanim, just harboring that hatred. Even if you didn't do anything, even if it's over the smallest things, the Mitzvah Sevet says, me'oreres midanim la'asos meriva u'lahakpir al davar kal. Lahakpir means to be adamant about the smallest little things. Lakpir al davar kal. You're going to make a big thing out of nothing, right? A mountain out of a molehill. And then the flip side of that, as we said, every pasuk is a contrast. V'al kol pesha'im, but when it comes to actually bad things, techase ahava, love will cover up those bad things. It's very interesting. There's also a parallel to the first pasuk, right? The pasuk we just said. The source of life is the mouth of a tzaddik, and the mouth of a wicked person covers violence. On the flip side, sina ta'ora medanim, hatred awakens these fights, right? Makes these fights out of little things. V'al kol pesha'im techaseh, same word as the Rasha in Yud Aleph. V'al kol pesha'im, and on all the bad things, techaseh ahava. Love will cover those bad things up. This is the opposite. What does it mean, the opposite, right? We said before that this is the contrast. So how is this a contrast? And this comes back to the example I just said. So for instance, you did nothing. You did something very innocent, right? You did something very innocent, you walk by the person that you don't like or they don't like you, and it becomes a big deal because they have this harboring hatred towards you, or they have this animosity, and they blow it into something which is unwarranted. The same thing happens in the opposite direction. A person loves you, even the bad things, right? Those little, not even little bad things, even the bad things, they'll be able to cover up through the love, right? So as opposed to the one who hates, the small things are going to become fights, but the one who loves, the big things are, even those aren't going to become fights. It's a very interesting contrast. And this is what we've talked about before, the halo effect. The halo effect being that, right, we talked about this is Daniel Kahneman's concept, that a person might meet someone for the first time, they get a good impression of them, and then they ask them, you know, what do you think, and somebody else asks, what do you think of so-and-so in terms of some completely irrelevant topic. And oftentimes, because of that first impression, you'll think positively about that irrelevant thing, right? If you remember, we did an interesting, even in the moment, we did an interesting experiment where we went through different descriptions of two different people, right? And the same list, but just backwards. The positive ones at the beginning and the negative ones at the beginning. And the one who for whom you thought positively at the beginning, you interpreted the later ones, right? If you remember, there was like, you know, industrious and organized and, you know, I forgot the other ones that it said, sly, like different words that could be interpreted in one way or the other. And if you had the sort of the positive one, intelligent and industrious before at the beginning, so you would interpret the end descriptions as more positive. If you had the cunning or the sly at the beginning of the sentence, you would think that the intelligence is being used for the negative. So it happens to all of us, but that's literally what's happening here. When you have an undercurrent of sinna, you have a negative impression of this person. So even the small things, the davar kal, like the Mitzvot David says, the davar kal, the little things are going to turn into big things. The alkol b'shaim, and the other way, if you have a positive impression of a person, you have a good association with them. Techase ava, even all the b'shaim, all the bad things that they might do, are going to be covered up by that impression, by that positivity that you have towards them. Which, as we pointed out last time, we talked about this, could be a good thing and could be a negative thing. You have to have the right positive impressions about the right people, right? You can't be, the used car salesman tries to make a good impression too, right? But you don't want to be swayed by the used car salesman. That would be the wrong person to have the positive impression about. You don't want to be swayed by that manipulation. So this is literally, the most explicit we've ever seen, the halo effect. Being talked about from Shlomo Melech and Mishlei, but a very interesting formulation of it. And then moving on, Yud Gimel, 10:13, Besifsei Navon, Timatzei Chachma. In the words, in the lips, Sifasim, lips, in the lips of one who understands, you will find wisdom. Veshevet legev, Chasar lev. Interesting rhyming there, but this is perhaps the most difficult to figure out how it's a contrast. Literally, what that translates to is, in 13, on the lips of an understanding one you will find wisdom, but a rod must be used on the back of one who lacks an understanding heart. So what does that mean? Presumably what it means is in terms of how to guide a person. Here, one could say, not necessarily exactly the case, but one could say that the first phrase is referring to the person who's listening, right? Besifsei Navon Timatzei Chachma, on the lips of one who has understanding, you'll find wisdom. It's basically saying you should listen. A person could listen to a person who can listen to the Navon will find wisdom. But someone who is chaser lev, someone who is lacking understanding, lacking that internal compass, that internal morality, will require the shevet. Shevet sometimes refers to a tribe, as we know. But shevet also refers to a stick, a rod, some kind of implement. I think it says that a couple of times by Moshe Rabbeinu's staff also. But either way, when it comes to here, so what it's saying is that that person who's listening to other people is never going to actually adhere to anything somebody else says. They're going to require the stick, meaning pressure, not necessarily physical pressure, but maybe even physical pressure for the person that doesn't really listen. So that's the contrast. The contrast is really about how to listen or what kinds of people listen. If you're willing to listen to the Navon, so Timatze Chachma, you'll find wisdom. But Vesheva Legev Chasar Lev, you'll have to force them to do that. And this is an interesting concept. I wish we could talk about it more. But there are two ways of saying this. But there are two kinds of discipline. There's the kind of discipline which is the discipline that transforms the listener. And there's the kind of discipline that compels the listener. And this is particularly, if you remember, those who were in the women's class on Tuesday afternoons for Parshas, it must have been Chukas, when we talked about Moshe hitting the rock. I actually don't know if we talked about this. We know in Parshas Beshalach, right? In Beshalach, Moshe Rabbeinu hits the rock and the water comes out. All of a sudden in the Chukas, he does the exact same thing and Hashem gets upset at him. So what's the difference? Why is it that originally he was allowed to hit the rock and now he's not allowed to hit the rock? How can you blame Moshe Rabbeinu? He did the same exact thing. Before it was okay, now it's not okay. The difference, maybe obviously, or the big difference is that the first time with the rock and the water was when the Jewish people were in their proverbial infancy, right? They were kids. When you deal with kids, so sometimes you compel them, not necessarily through a stick and hitting, but it's a metaphor to having to sort of, you know, force it out of them, right? And you know, this is the great example is what we did over Simchas Torah. What do we do for Simchas Torah? We tell the kids, you celebrate with the Torah and you'll get candy, right? So why do we have to do that? Just tell them to you know, celebrate the Torah. Well, obviously a kid doesn't understand the depths of why the Torah is so important and therefore understand why we should celebrate it. So we compel them with candy, right? That's the whole point. We compel them. We force them in a way. But the point is not that they should be reinforced for the rest of their lives. You know, imagine if you had to give candy to an adult in order for them to go to work, right? You at some point, you're supposed to develop that sense, that moral compass, where you don't have to be compelled to do the right thing. And that's the essence of raising children. That's the essence of teaching students, right? The essence of bringing up a child is to transition them from the shevet legev chaser lev, right? To transition them from the person who needs a rod because they are chaser lev, they don't have that understanding heart yet. Transition them to navon timatze chachma, to the person who can intuit the wisdom that's coming from an understanding person. They don't need any more compulsion in order to actually do the right thing because they understand. They understand what the right thing to do is something they should do because it's the right thing to do, and not because of the reward. And this, by the way, while it is more explicit with children, it's sadder, but also more subtle with adults. And this literally, this happens almost every day. You can find examples of this. The ability of saying that I should do something only because it's right. You can count the people that you see during the day. You can count them on your hand how many people live life like that. To do something only because it's right, not because of any other benefits. It's very rare that you find a person that only lives like that. I remember once I was an intern in New Rochelle, I think it was, for an architect before, you know, as I was juggling whether I should be a rabbi or go into to be a balabas. So one of my career pursuits, aspirations was to be an architect. It sounds kind of like off, you know, out of left field, but that's, you know, I have a sort of like a artistic gene. So either way, so I was pursuing architecture. Ultimately, by the way, one of the deciding factors of becoming a rabbi was because I told Ricky on one of our first dates, I said, I'm either going to be an architect and move to Israel, try to make a living in Israel as an architect, or I'm going to be a, you know, a congregational rabbi, and those don't exist in Israel, so I'll have to do that in America. So she said, I think you should be a rabbi. That's what she said. Either way, so one of my early internships was with an architect in New Rochelle, and he was working one of these like not a townhouse, but one of those very skinny apartment buildings, skinny homes in Brooklyn. You know, they're like, they have like 5 feet in between, just enough of space to like get your garbage cans in there. I don't know if people know Brooklyn over here. But either way, for those of you who've ever seen Brooklyn, you know what I'm talking about. They sacrifice lawns for more buildings. So my boss, the head of the architecture firm, you know, asked me if I wanted to drive him to this project in Brooklyn. So first of all, I'm like a sophomore in college, maybe a junior, I don't remember. And I'd never driven in New York at all. No less driven somebody else's car in New York. And no less I'd never driven somebody else's car in Brooklyn in New York before. So I was kind of worried. But, you know, this is the boss. I'm trying to get, you know, good graces. If, you know, the internship goes well, maybe it could lead to other things. He had a couple other firm guys in the firm, so it was a good job, potentially. So I said, okay, great. Yeah, I'll do it. I don't even remember the last time I had driven at that point because I was in Israel. I was dorming, whatever. Either way, so we're driving. We get to Brooklyn. Finally, get to Brooklyn. I'm being very cautious. And, you know, as usual, you know, when you get to a yellow light, especially when you're in somebody else's car, and especially when you're in Brooklyn, so the yellow light means to slow down. So I see the yellow. It's clearly yellow, so I start slowing down. The guy behind me sees the yellow, sees that I'm slowing down, and zooms around me to beat the light. I said, this only happens in Brooklyn. What's interesting about that, it's not necessarily that, because you kind of expect that from Brooklyn, you know, Brooklyn dwellers. What's interesting about that is what my boss said afterwards. He said, you know, you should never do that. And I said, okay, I mean, obviously you shouldn't do that. It's the wrong thing to do. He said, you should never do that because you never know who's going to be in the car you're cutting off. Who's going to be in the car in front of you? He said, one time I was driving and I cut off this car, and it ended up being my son's principal. And I had to face, you know, I had to face the music, the next parent-teacher conference. And I was thinking to myself, like, yeah, that sounds like a terrible consequence. But that's not the reason you shouldn't cut people off. The reason you shouldn't cut people off is because it's wrong to cut people off, right? This is how some people think. It's only wrong if there's a repercussion to it. If it's not going to cause any dire consequence, so then it's not a problem. But that's not the actual way you should live life. And that's what it's saying here. It might not be as literal as a shevet legev chaser lev. It might not be as literal as a rod that's compelling you to do a certain activity. But too many people will only do things because there's some kind of compulsion through consequence. That the only reason they'll do it is because it'll lead to something bad afterwards. Somebody might see me, or somebody might know who I am, and therefore it's going to turn out bad when I do this. So that's also a shevet legev chaser lev. That's also a rod that's compelling a person. That's also something you have to avoid. Oh, look who it is. Speaking of children, you have to compel. You never have to compel this one to come to shear. You say hi? Yeah. You say hi. Yes, he still naps and he still stays up late because of it. Okay, you want to keep learning? Yeah. Okay, we're going to keep learning. Yud Dalet, Pasuk 14. Chachamim Yitzpenu Das.
Rabbi.
Yavin.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go for it.
So, you know how they say certain things you, if you do them for the wrong reason, they will bring you to do them for the right reason. Does that fall in that category, or is that just not?
So this is actually very interesting. This is very, hey, mister, what are you doing? So this is very interesting. That's actually a line in the Gemara. One line in the Gemara tells us, in one place it says, "Mitov shelo lishma balishma." If you do something for the wrong, non-ideal reasons, then ultimately it will lead you to do them for the right reasons. And then another Gemara says, anyone who does something lo lishma, it's better for them not to have been created. So all the commentaries ask, wait a second, well, which one is it? Should you do it for the non-ideal purpose because it's going to lead to you doing it for the right reasons? What are you doing? Okay, we got to be quiet. I'm trying to explain something. So which one is it? So the you want to go down?
No.
So you have to stop, okay? So the commentaries explain one way or another that it depends on the non-ideal motivation. Right, so Tosfos talks about if you're doing it so that you can, so that you can support yourself, you're doing it so that you can have some kind of honor as a rabbi. So then, those are some. There's an element of an idea of a good reason for it. But if your reason is so that you can, you manipulate other people, if your reason is so that you can trick other people, right? So it depends on what the lo lishma is. So in this case, the lo lishma is never ideal, right? The purpose is always to be ideal, but the question is, how lo lishma is the lo lishma, right? There's a difference between not ideal and for a bad reason, right? There's a gray zone, there's a gap there that the Gemara is trying to hint towards, which I think is the point. Now, I can't tell you exactly what the how to define it, because it'll depend on every situation, but I think that's how you have to understand it. But yeah, you're right. And that's
the raisin and the recalcitrant husband who won't give a get.
You want me to get, you're trying to get me political here? Yeah, no, for
no,
that.
I'm just saying that that's what it implies, really, also.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting. The Rambam tells us a very interesting line, and I'm not saying anything practical in this way. But the Rambam says a line, and I take it more to be as observation more than anything else, which is that he says that if a person is not giving a get, so then you can compel him through force until he says rotza ani, until he says I want to divorce, right? That's what you're talking about. And then the Rambam explains that as if to say the reason he's not going to do it is because he's blinding himself, right? His own desires are blinding himself. Meaning, if he would listen to his better nature, he would understand why this is the right thing to do, right? So when do we invoke that concept? I have no idea. I'm not going to sit here and try to come up with it. But that could be another instance of shevet legev chaser lev. If you're dealing with a chaser lev, you got to take extreme measures by compulsion, not necessarily physical threats. Nowadays, we have other things. We have the halachic prenup, we have cherems, we have other means of compulsion, which are within legal norms that we have to follow. So yeah, you're right, that could be another instance of compulsion that we have to follow. Okay, so the next pasuk, Yud Dalet. Chachamim yitzbenu das. Wise people hide their wisdom. This is a very interesting line. Chachamim yitzbenu das. Wise men, or wise people, will hide their knowledge. They'll conceal their knowledge. It's very interesting. If you're wise, so why would you conceal it? And then if you look at the next part, upi evil mechita krova. And as opposed to the wise person who hides his wisdom, who hides his knowledge, the mouth of a fool brings ruin near. Now, again, you don't see the contrast explicitly, but the difference here is the chacham, the wise person, doesn't speak a lot, and the evil, the fool, speaks a lot. So the point is, and this is what the commentaries basically say, The point is that the person who feels like he has to talk all the time is naturally going to say something bad, naturally going to say something wrong. Here they quote from Rabbeinu Yonah, but it's a long piece. Rashi, so the Rabbeinu Yonah says, "Ha'ava yilavet besvasav yomar kol ha'ola arucho." Very interesting line. Kol ha'ola arucho means anything that comes to mind, right? Anything that comes to his head. He has no filter. Gam ki agia nezek b'davar berchilos melshinos v'otzas diba ve'etzarab. Things are going to, besides the fact that he's going to start saying, give out bad, he's going to say actually bad things, eventually he'll say things that might even be true, but they're also going to be hurtful. Al kein yiyapiv mechita krova lebrios. There's going to be some kind of destruction. The word mechita is a very interesting word, also relevant to next week's Parsha. Is next week's Parsha? I don't remember. Either way, interesting word. Mechate means like in halachic language to stoke the coals. Mechate bekecholim. Either way, a person who speaks a lot is going to cause damage one way or another. And on the flip side, maybe you could say that that's what the Chacham makes sure not to do. Yitzminu Das means, maybe it means, that he doesn't speak so much, right? As the Mishnah Avos tells us, that, right? Kol Yomai Gadalti Bein Chachamim, V'lo Matzasi, something, L'Chachma Gadol Mishtika, something like that. I haven't found, anything better for wisdom than just being quiet, which is an interesting concept. But that Mishnah seems to be more about listening to other people, right? If you're quiet, you'll be able to listen from others, which is obviously important, but this pasuk doesn't sound like that. This pasuk sounds chachamim yitzbenu das, meaning they'll conceal their knowledge. Now, there are different ways of saying this, different ways of understanding it. Let me just see for a second. Where did that book go? Well, here it is. I want to look at Rav Hirsch on this for a second. This is 10:14, so I got to find it. 1:18, that's where we were at last time. Wise people know a great deal and foresee many things which they keep to themselves. This is interesting, and people might make a connection politically here, but that's not my point in saying it. Wise people know a great deal and foresee many things which they keep to themselves so as to not spread unnecessary panic. If they know a bunch of things, they might know some dangerous information. They're, because of their wisdom, they understand things about the world that might scare people. Instead, they'll conceal that knowledge, right? So it's not really about being quiet so that you can learn, so you can be righteous. It's more about you're concealing certain pieces of information that will hurt other people. Is very interesting also in terms of what people can take. There's a certain level of wisdom which is about knowing things, and then there's a certain level of wisdom which is about allowing others to know things that are good for them at that time, right? Be'ito b'zmano. Every person is at a certain stage in life, and every person has a certain knowledge level. And it's not necessarily the case that the truth is always something you should tell them. Not to say you should lie to them, chas v'shalom. But you don't always have to tell someone everything if it's going to be detrimental to them. So here, that's what it means. Chachamim yitzbenu das. The chachamim, really wise people, don't only know things, but they know when to say things that they know. I remember once there was a Rosh Hashiva at YU. Rav Ozer Glickman, Zichrono Levracha, he was a very, very intelligent man, very, very interesting man. He slept like 3 hours a day. I don't know if people know him. I feel like I talked to somebody about him recently. Maybe he was related to someone in Detroit. I don't remember. Either way, so Rabbi Glickman once was speaking. He was once the Shabbos guest at YU, and I stayed in for Shabbos at YU a lot because I was an out of towner. That's how it goes, for other reasons too, but whatever. And so he was the Shabbos guest. And it was Friday night. They had these Q&As. So he asked, he's a big into philosophy. Very, very intelligent person. And he once said something very interesting, which in some ways is, off-putting, but in other ways is quite skillful. He said that sometimes he'll be arguing on a philosophical point with another person, and he knows that the real true argument for a certain philosophical idea, this person wouldn't grasp, and they'd have trouble, and it'll take forever for them to understand it. But this person is, hacking his chinic about doing this thing or that thing, and arguing with him about something. So he says that sometimes he'll give a simpler answer to the person, even though he knows it's not true. He knows an argument that can debunk that argument. But for this person, that argument works. And that would sort of get him out of the conversation. Very interesting. You have to be very intelligent to understand not only the piece of information, but also how it would be received by the other person. It's sort of a level of knowledge which goes beyond just knowing things. You also have to know other people, and you also have to know how other people's, personalities would receive that knowledge. So here, that's what it's saying. I wanted to say a different twist on this phrase, which is Chachamim Yitzbenu Das means that sometimes a Chacham knows what he knows and he doesn't feel the need to tell other people. Right? So, for instance, we just talked about Shevet Legev Chaser Lev. You have to compel a person to do what they're supposed to do. Some people, if they're wise, they don't feel the need to tell people, everything that's good for them. Because, you're confident in what's true. It's not your place to tell this person. That person's not going to believe you anyway. We talk about this in the rebuke classes, the Tochacha classes. But the point being that, if you see someone who disagrees with you, for instance, I think about this a lot, in the times that we're in. You see someone who's, sometimes every couple of days you see one of these videos of people reprimanding other people for not wearing masks. Or for wearing masks, right? Someone told me a story recently that they went into a shul and they had in the shul some kind of like air purifier machine going on. So a guy came in and he said, "Ugh, you don't need that thing. The whole thing's a sham, right? The whole COVID thing." So I said to the guy, so this person asked me, like, how do you like respond? How do you think of a person like that? Like, what am I supposed to think about them? So I said to him, the odds are that that person doesn't really believe that it's a sham. The reason that he feels the need to talk about that air purifier is because he feels defensive for not wearing a mask. He feels defensive over not taking precautions. So instead of being confident over the fact that he knows the truth, right? If you really knew the truth, you wouldn't feel like you have to say something like that. If you really thought that it's all a sham, so why do you feel the need to convince other people about it? Just go on with your life. Let other people do what they do, and you do what you do. Why are you feeling the need to make your argument against other people? And this is something I remember. I have a friend who always used to tell us that he didn't believe in God. He's a sort of a rabble rouser, and he used to sometimes bring it up in part jest, in sheer, when we were in high school. He lived Jewishly, and he was just sort of like, he poked, he pushed buttons. But either way, sometimes he would make these arguments in the middle of class. And I remember Rebbe would always say, he said, if you really believed there was no God, you wouldn't feel the need to make that argument. Because someone who really believes that, okay, just go about your day. Like, we're not bothering you. So what does it hurt you that we believe in God? It only is a problem for a person if they feel threatened by somebody else's belief. If you really were confident in the wisdom that you had, if you really thought something was true, so you wouldn't feel the need to tell somebody else about it, to disprove somebody else's feelings, unless that obviously was hurting somebody or they were doing something wrong because of it. So maybe that's what it means here. Chachamim Yitzbenu Das. Wise people don't feel the need to tell everybody else what they think is true. Because real truth, if you're a real chacham, you're really a wise person, you don't feel the need to convince everybody else that your truth is the real truth. Because you're confident in it. So Yitzbenu Das, you don't feel the need to convince other people. Interesting concept. I think very, very relevant to the days we're in, where for whatever reason, on social media or politically, everybody feels like they have to make their argument to the other person. If you really believe something, so you don't really feel the need to make the argument, right? Why do you feel the need to convince everybody else of your thought unless you felt threatened by the fact that everybody else thinks that way, right? The only reason that you feel the need to convince somebody is because you're defensive about it. Because you don't really believe it wholeheartedly. If you really believed it wholeheartedly, you wouldn't feel the need to convince somebody. So maybe that's what it means. Chachamim yitzmenu das. And maybe on the flip side, pi evel mechita krova, if a person feels like they need to talk about something all the time, so they're always going to get in fights. They're always going to destroy things. I just want to get the next two psukim in, and then we'll stop because I need a rest. Tesvav, hon ashir kiryas huzo, mechitas dalim resham. Literally translated, it means, a rich man's wealth is his citadel of strength. Right? So it's a person's wealth is, you know, the stuff that he can build. But poverty is the ruin of the impoverished, right? The fact that they have no money is their downfall. So it sounds a very strange pasuk. It doesn't sound like something that Shlomo Melech would feel the need to tell us about. So on the one hand, which is always a good rule of thumb, you could interpret it to be referring to wisdom. It could refer to Torah knowledge, right? The wealth of a rich person is how much Torah knowledge he has, right? The poverty of a poor person is how little he has. Rabbeinu Yonah says it's not true. You have to read it with the next pasuk. Hon asher kiryas uzo mechitas dalim resham. A rich person thinks that his wealth is what defines him, and that's his strength. And the poor person is defined by his poverty. But really, peulas tzadik l'chaim. It's the activities of a righteous person that makes his life worthwhile. Tevuas rasha l'chatas. And the produce of a wicked person is his sin. It doesn't matter what your lot in life is. Maybe you were successful in business. Maybe you had a little luck. Maybe you inherited some money. Maybe you won the lottery. Maybe you don't have money. Maybe you grew up in, you know, in difficult times. Maybe you don't have the same success you were hoping for in your job. But that's not the definition of your life. The definition of your life is pu'ulas tzadik l'chaim. The actions of a righteous person are his life. This is how Rabbeinu Yonah understands these two psukim. It's a beautiful, beautiful way to understand it because the first pasuk sounds like there's something great and strong about having wealth and something terrible about not having wealth. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, it's not true. It's true. The truth is that as long as you're a good person, that's going to be your defining quality in life. You should never be defined by the wealth that you have. You should be defined by the activities that you do. I think I've said this story before, where I have a friend, harps on, and one of his pet peeves is when we ask kids when they're little, we ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they all respond with some kind of occupation. I want to be a firefighter, I want to be a baseball player, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor, whatever it is. But they don't realize that the question wasn't, what do you want to do when you grow up? That's not what we ask. We say, what do you want to be when you grow up? What kind of person? Do you want to be kind? Do you want to be sincere? Do you want to be authentic? Do you want to be learned? Right? Who do you want to be? Not what do you want to do? Too often we define ourselves based on the work and the wealth that we accrue based on our success in business or in our jobs or whatever it might be, or how little we do, or how little success we have, and how little money we have, how small our house is, what kind of car we drive. And the truth is that in the end of the day, pu'ulas tzadik l'chaim, tvuas rasha l'chatas. In the end of the day, it's about what we do. It's about the activities, the life that we lead as people, not the careers that we have as wealth accruers or the lack thereof. So that's a lot of information there. A lot of, you know, as we said before, some of these things are connected, some of them aren't connected. It's sort of like a potpourri at this point in Mishlei, these little couplets, little contrasts, very interesting to delve into and to sort of to unearth. But not always the same kind of fluid theme that we've had. So there are a bunch of little nuggets of wisdom from Shlomo Melech. From Eretz Hashem, next week we'll pick up with the Pasuk Yud Zayin 70. Next week is Rosh Chodesh, so we'll probably do a Legends and Lessons. Stay tuned to who it will be. Okay, everyone should be well. Shkayach, everyone.
Thank you.